Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. How many of you here have, at one point in your life, read either the Iliad or the Odyssey? How many of you have heard of it if you've not read it?
Boy, that's a lot of hands.
Yeah. I mean, it's a classic. It's part of our consciousness. And I came across a book the other day, as have many other people recently, called The Lost Books of the Odyssey, a novel by Zachary Mason. And it was a beautiful book to read. And thank you for writing it. And welcome to West Coast Live.
Thanks. My pleasure.
So what appealed to you about the story of the Odyssey that you wanted to create, you know, 50 or so, 40 different little imaginings of stories of what happened to Odysseus and Achilles and Penelope?
Well, there are lots of things that drew me to it. One of them is that it's just a beautiful story, and it's a story with holes in it. Like, there are things that are important but never touched on, like Athena doesn't speak to Odysseus between the time he leaves Troy and gets back to Ithaca. And so this is probably because the Odyssey is actually a mishmash of other sources. There's the Trojan War, and then there are some sort of miscellaneous adventure tales strung into the middle. But it's interesting to imagine that it's coherent and try to find the hidden explanations and the sort of underlying threads of meaning that would make it whole.
And other possibilities. And by training, you're a computer programmer who's interested in, what is it, algorithms and search, very Google-like way of thinking in the world.
Sort of. I'm actually interested in artificial intelligence. So I do things with search and recommendation systems for work, but academically I'm more interested in a computational understanding of cognition.
So the Odyssey makes absolute sense as a part of that world.
It was a natural extension of my work, yeah.
But in a way, I mean, thinking about it, I mean, one of the things that Odysseus was well known for was his cleverness and his way of sussing out situations and his stratagems. And that's all very kind of rational thinking, but it also requires, you know, his emotional intelligence to be at the fore.
Certainly that's the case. Odysseus was no bloodless academic. His intelligence was always applied.
Applied intelligence, Odysseus. There you are. That's a Homeric epithet in a way.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
There are a number of beautiful sections in here. Each one of the stories is anywhere from a page to three or four pages, and they resonate with you as you remember the accounts of the great mythical stories. But they're different stories. I mean, some of them Odysseus sneaks away from battle and leads another kind of life entirely. I mean, you imagine these different endings and different existences,
mm-hmm.
Even within the same story.
Yes, so the book is sort of like a dream about the Odyssey. The elements are reused and recycled in different ways, and the same events are revisited again and again. So I think there are five different versions of Odysseus coming back to Ithaca. And there's the chapter you alluded to, where Odysseus is basically a frustrated intellectual in a Bronze Age society of what amount to brainless jocks. And that seems like a kind of plausible account of how it actually was.
You know, I saw Hector's love of country and family opposed by Achilles' madness for glory and his slight impatience for the death he knew was closing in on him. And overlaying them all were the passions and rivalries of the bright gods, like sirocco winds scouring everything they touched. Finally, I saw myself, how my wit exceeded that of other men, but gave me no leverage against fate. That was an amazing line. And how in time to come it would avail me nothing but possibly an understanding of the full scope of my helplessness. That was beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there he is. I mean, the witty guy amongst the jocks of the Bronze Age, and knowing it doesn't make a bit of difference in one of these stories.
That's a recurring theme in the book. There are a lot of stories that I think of as sort of anti-detective stories, insofar as Sherlock Holmes and his ilk are all about the triumph of rationality over apparent monstrosity. Actually, Scooby-Doo is like that now. But But there are stories in this book where Odysseus, who's massively intelligent, uses his powers of deduction to try to understand and escape from his circumstances, and they just sort of consume him nonetheless. So,
I think that's the first time I've ever had Scooby-Doo and Odysseus and Homer kind of linked in the same sentence. And here's one, a moat in oceanic darkness. Do you mind if I read this a little bit here? Waterlogged, frozen, exhausted, Odysseus clung to a floating spar, dark waves surging over him. He could not help but think that this was happening to someone else, that someone, a stranger, was being consumed by the sea, was near drowning. His teeth had long since stopped chattering when a werelight appeared on the waters, and his mind went from pain and dullness to clarity. Pallas Athena was with him. He said, "Goddess, who are you to find me and bear me up when I am lost in the waste?" In the sudden stillness, she said, "Water flowing through pipes, pouring into unlit reservoirs, there to eddy in silence, runes of ephemeral fire, a book of many pages written in inks that vanish and reappear, a twilight forest haunted by beasts, watchful and inquisitive, steadfast of heroes, an onion, an ocean, a palimpsest, a staccato machine of oiled iron gears. These are among the metaphors with which I describe myself, like a hand trying to grasp itself by reaching into a mirror." What a great description of Pallas Athena, you know, the goddess of wisdom and intelligence, who befriends Odysseus and helps him, sometimes abandons him. He sometimes lusts after her, she after him.
Well, the lust is not present in Homer, or if it is, it's implicit.
Well, it's in your book.
It is in my book, yes.
Yeah. So why did you, how did you sort of think of Pallas Athena as this, as a more imagined creature than she is in the Odyssey?
Well, so that was one of the ways I approached the book. I tried well, Homer is not particularly psychological. We more see what happened than why.
Plot, plot, plot.
Plot, 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 narrative, narrative, narrative. There are a few exceptions, but that's mostly how it works. So imagining the actual motivations and psychologies of the characters, human or noumenal, I thought could be revealing. And it seemed like that was a good explanation for why she abandoned him.
So there have been other wonderful translations of the Odyssey and so forth, which have taken it, you know, the story fairly literally. But you make the very wonderful point through these stories that it's about stories. I was thinking about the idea of dreams, that people often describe movies as dreams, that we go into this darkened space. And I thought reading each one of these chapters is like having individual dreams. And that's what these stories are. And they're, you know, people get caught in tombs and they have to use twine to get out, perhaps, but then maybe they make a misturning anyway. Mm-hmm. And another fate awaits them if they don't go the other way. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're dreams.
They're much like that. So the sort of structure of the book is a little dreamlike, and it also draws on the fact that there was an oral tradition of the Homerica, that is, it was told by bards who had learned it from other bards and so on. And in that way, it would inevitably keep changing. So whether or not there was a historical Homer, the sort of author of Homer's works are these generations of storytellers until somebody wrote it down and it crystallized. So that kind of licenses playing with the story, I think. And one of the things I did was sort of make the book aware of its kind of chaotic and inchoate character.
So there's a, without giving anything away in this particular story necessarily, a man, nameless, is in some sort of cabin somewhere. He doesn't know where he is. It's a season that doesn't change, perhaps like Hawaii, except it's winter. But he sort of finally looks around and he finds a book hidden in the cabin and he starts reading it. And it's the story of a man coming back from a war, getting lost on his way home. I mean, he sort of reads his own, and he realizes in order to save himself, in this particular story, he must destroy himself. Otherwise, the gods will hound him down. And so he burns this book, which tells his story.
Of course, it's actually a little less definite than that. So you can read it the way you outlined it, or you can also read it as a delusion. Like, he's just a man who knows virtually nothing, alone in the woods, and he finds a book, and he reads himself into it, possibly incorrectly.
So given your interest in computers and artificial intelligence, how comfortable, you must be very comfortable then with the idea of varying interpretations of stories.
Certainly, yes. I'm not sure how much my AI background influences that. I've often wondered what the connection is between my two lives. There are little points of contact, like there's one chapter in the book whose structure will be familiar to mathematicians, but...
How so?
So it's the chapter called Fragment. I forget which number it is. So that's the Epimenides paradox, or the Librarian paradox, or it's a common paradox with lots of forms.
Which was the, it was called Fragment?
Yeah.
Here it is, page 71.
Yep.
Oh, it's half a page. A single fragment is all that survives of the 45th book of the Odyssey. Did you make that up?
Yes.
Okay. Odysseus, finding that his reputation for trickery preceded him, started inventing histories for himself and disseminating them wherever he went. This had the intended effect of clouding perception and distorting expectation, making it easier for him to work as he was wont, and the unexpected effect that one of his lies became, with minor variations, the Odyssey of Homer.
Mm-hmm.
So explain the connection between that and mathematics.
So the Liar's Paradox is roughly, the statement is false. So if the statement is true, then it's false, but if it's false, then it's true, and so you get this sort of churning cycle of interpretations. And this is kind of similar insofar as Odysseus is telling, well, in the Odyssey, we have Odysseus telling lots of lies, one of which becomes the Odyssey, and so this sort of similar vortex.
And of course, one of the great lies, great ruses that he comes up with is the Trojan horse to enter the city of Troy. And one of the chapters you have is called Cassandra. And I suppose that's another mathematical formula, that everything she tells is true, but everyone will believe it to be false.
Yes. And so in the end of that chapter, she is trying to warn her relatives not to get engaged in this war, to flee, to do anything except face the fate that she knows is coming for them. And she also knows what's going to happen to her. She is going to see her family die. She's going to be enslaved and kidnapped. But she knows by various signs visible only to her that this time her prophecy isn't right and that she'll be okay.
Did you have any sort of resonance as you were writing this with current events, political events, war in Iraq?
No, that actually never crossed my mind. Although I'm a big believer in the idea that it's the reader's interpretation rather than the author's intention that matters. And so, yeah, when I first read a review that said perhaps he was talking about the war in Iraq, I thought, oh, that's a good point. That's that's insightful.
So the publishing history of this book is very interesting. You entered it in a competition with a small press. I was interested to see that it has copyright dates of 2007 and 2010. And was it Starcheron Press? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
You won a contest for best novel in that, and it came out in a small run. It had slightly, I guess, a different configuration. Mm-hmm. The author was more present, i.e. you. Mm-hmm. And then FSG picked it up, made some changes in it, and sent it out into the world. And it must feel different to you in some way.
It does a little. It's kind of strange that people are actually reading it in their profusions. I should also say that actually I made the changes and convinced FSG to go along with them rather than vice versa.
Oh, the other way around. Oh,
yeah. So I stand by entirely the text. So yes, it's always kind of fun doing readings, and now doing this insofar as it's more viscerally credible evidence that somebody's read the book than a sales figure, which is kind of fun.
Is there what is your sense of Odysseus as a character? I mean, you clearly spend a lot of time imagining these stories and imagining an emotional life for this character who was... sort of condemned in the Odyssey we know to this very long voyage home, losing his men through various encounters with Cyclops and other monsters of the sea and Poseidon's anger and all that. But what emotionally did you begin to feel about him that allowed you to sort of create these different kind of, sort of shards of his emotional life?
Well, so Odysseus is probably the most filled out of all the Homeric characters, but even then, there's not that much to him. He's extremely intelligent. Despite that, he's a hero and warrior like everybody else. I thought that sort of the points of light and the mist that allowed me to infer his character in various ways were situational. Mostly the sort of sense of being trapped between a war that was a long time in the past and an island that probably forgot him, but that he very much wants to return to a long way in the future. And there's the sequence of islands in between, and his trajectory is kind of chaotic, and he becomes very, very lost, and both the starting point and the notional end point are difficult to believe at some point.
And Penelope's character changes. I mean, sometimes she takes on all the suitors as lovers and doesn't avoid them. Sometimes Achilles is, you make him this incredible killing machine, coppery beautiful, and yet at some point, as he's just endlessly victorious, he forgets what it is to fail and ends up feeling alone and as if he has no wisdom.
Yeah, I did the sort of same thing with Achilles that I did with Odysseus. And Achilles's primary characteristic is his pride and his invincibility. He's immune to weapons, at least in some versions of the stories. And I thought about what that would do to you. I mean, combat of any kind is incredibly terrifying, but if somebody can walk up and stab you in the chest and you don't even need to notice, that would have an effect on you. And where would you go from there?
I mean, he sits around the campfire sort of stabbing himself in the heart for amusement.
In one. I think he stabs himself in the hand generally, but if he's drunk, he tries the heart.
Yeah. So these are short pieces. Did you decide early on that they would be short pieces?
So I think it was Borges who said that he'd read few novels because he always felt there was something to excess in them. And I feel the same thing. So I wanted to write fiction in which there was absolutely nothing to excess. Originally, no chapter was going to be more than 2 or 3 pages, but that constraint slipped over time. But you can still see its influence on the book.
You and Elmore Leonard, you know what Elmore Leonard has said about this? He said, how do you write a good book? And he said, you leave out the parts that the reader skips.
That's my expressed philosophy, pretty much, yeah.
Did you have a collection of various translations of the Odyssey that you poured through and absorbed?
It would have been really sensible if I'd had, and I'm somewhat surprised to say that it's actually been a long time since I read the Odyssey. I think in part because with what I was trying to do to it, I wasn't trying to write credible Homeric verse. I was more trying to manipulate the essence of the book and try to find the book behind the book. And so it seemed more appropriate to work from the traces that had left in my memory from a reading a decade ago.
You talk in these incredible sentences that I just realized it was. Would these pieces come to you of a whole, or would you sort of come back and work at them? Would there be sketches, elements to various of the stories, and you'd see how the pieces would fit together?
Both. So sometimes I'd be sitting in front of my computer and then I could hardly type fast enough to keep up. And then I'd go change a few words and it would be done. And that would be great. And others required immense labor and God only knows how many thousands of revisions. And there was also some work to get them to talk to each other in the right way. So, yes.
How do you mean talk to each other?
It's not a short story collection. Well,
it's not.
It's not a novel either. I'm not sure exactly what it is. Something in between. The cover says it's a novel, but I would probably disagree with the cover.
No, it's a novel. No.
There are lots of relationships between the stories. Like they'll pick up this. Well, you can put them together in different ways to make a coherent, longer narrative. They refer to each other. Like there's one story where Odysseus is a bard and the stories he's telling to his patrons can be found under different but clearly recognizable names in other chapters in the book. The same elements get reused again and again. In fact, I don't think there's anything in the book that's used only once. Everything interpenetrates multiple stories.
But you also retell the story of Circe and Calypso in different ways too, throughout, that are all in a way credible. And in a way, I mean, they feel sort of emotionally right in the way that when you read the original Odyssey, they're kind of mysterious and very distanced by a mythological formality.
Yeah, that was my feeling too, and I wanted to get closer to it, closer to whatever thing was underlying the actual story. Not that there ever actually was probably anything underlying the story, but it's still a nice place to start. It's some mist to go through.
Speaking of mists, I mean, there are a lot of mists in the book and fogs. I mean, they plays a very important role. People can't see things because of the fog. They get lost. They get turned around. Mm-hmm. Mists get revealed. People come out of mists. There are sounds that you hear. I mean, that sort of unknowing, that unseeingness is a big part of this.
Yes, uncertainty, dislocation, blindness are major themes throughout the book.
Now, how did Alexander, as in Alexander the Great, get into this story?
Well, I've been really interested in Alexander since I was about 10, so in a sense, that's how. And then there's the fact that he explicitly modeled his life on Achilles. He tried actively to identify himself with Achilles, which is in the Alexander story. The thing about him and his best friend Hephaestus running around Achilles' tomb and being hailed as the new Achilles and Patroclus is true. And so then I took that and extended it a little. And also, by the time we get to that point in the book, even the constraints that inform the book are coming a little unhinged, and it's turning sort of strange. And so there's one about chess and one about Alexander and so on.
The book is called The Lost Books of the Odyssey, and so don't believe where it says a novel. published by FSG and Zachary Mason, M-A-S-O-N. And this is what John Banville said about it. He said, a subtle, inventive, and moving meditation on the nature of story and what Lewis McNeice calls the drunkenness of things being various. Wow. Whoa. Another one of those blurbs that you go, hmm.
It was very gratifying. Oh, there's also a blurb by Harry Matthews, who's the only American member of ULIPO, which was this European society interested in the intersection between literature and mathematics. So I'm especially pleased to have this connection.
So it says here, Harry Matthews, author of My Life in CIA?
That's right.
What did he do in the CIA?
It's a work of fiction masquerading as biography. I'm not sure exactly how much of it is true.
Well, I can understand the appeal for you.
I think that
artificial intelligence, artificial truth, I don't know. Yeah.
So in the book, he's living on his trust fund in Paris, and people keep thinking he's a spook for some reason, and eventually he goes along with it, and complications ensue.
That sounds like it's a good book. Why does he call it a theosophist's dream of abstract mathematics? I saw that, and I wondered, you know, where's the theosophy in the book?
The theosophy is invisible now. It was.
Well, this was for the original.
That's what? Right. I see. The first edition had a much more complicated frame story. So in the second edition, there's a one-page preface that explains where this mysterious text was found. But in the first edition, there's a 20-page introduction and a 20-page appendix.
Wow.
And
that would imagine would change sort of the whole feel of the book, would make it less dreamlike in a way.
Actually, the dreamlike character, I think, was, if anything, enhanced by the old introduction and appendix. So, in short, there was an ancient manuscript. It was in code. Nobody thought there was anything there, but it kept being passed down through history. Eventually, somebody decoded it, or thought they had, except that the decoding was very strange, and it wasn't really clear whether there was anything linguistic there, or whether they were looking at white noise and sort of inventing meanings to go on it. And then there was also speculation that these versions of the Odyssey were sort of written to the fabric of mathematical logic in the same way that Muslims believe the Quran is an essential aspect of the universe. So that was a fun thing to play with, and that's what he's remarking on in that blurb.
So why'd you take it out?
There was one element of it that I didn't really like, and to take that out would sort of invalidate the rest of it, and then the entire frame collapsed. So I decided that it would be a cleaner and tighter book with the minimal preface.
All right. It's clean and tight. And so when you go, when you're at home, I mean, what do you look at on the internet?
Not too much. Building blog, boing boing sometimes.
But I mean, when you do your artificial intelligence work, I mean, how does that tie in with your daily life?
Oh, it's just sort of part of my daily life. I have these various threads. I work for a startup in Silicon Valley, and I do my research, which is leading up to a return to academia one of these days, and I'm working on...
Bloodless academia? Is that what you call it? That'll get you right in.
Yeah, I think you have to be exsanguinated before before they give you tenure. And I'm working on some new books.
Just get one of those bronze swords that'll exsanguinate anyone in a second.
Yes.
Zachary Mason, thank you very much for being on West Coast Live.
Thank you.
Thank you. The Lost Books of the Odyssey. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.